Quick disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities or to make or consider any investment or course of action. For more information, go to bestevershow.com.
The supply and demand imbalances, and I think what is a little bit of a contrarian approach, and now you're starting to see some more positive news come about the retail side of the business just because of how undersupplied we are.
Welcome to the Best Ever Show, the world's longest running daily commercial real estate podcast. Our hosts interview commercial real estate experts every day to get you the best advice ever with none of the fluffy stuff.
Best Ever listeners, welcome to the Best Real Estate Investing Advice Ever Show. I'm your host, Joe Cornwell, and today I'm joined by Jeremy Kuchenbecker. Hopefully I pronounced that right. Jeremy is the APCO Holdings VP of Enterprise Digital Strategy. He has an automotive third-party administrative insurance company. He's going to explain that to us. He's also an LP investor in over 27 investments, and he's done some active investing as well. And Jeremy is going to tell us his story today about how he reached financial freedom at an early age, and I'm excited to hear it. So Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, appreciate it, Joe. And I got to give you credit because you know my last name, so... Pass off.
Good. Well, yeah, that was a tough one. I was sounding it out as I went, but I'm glad. I appreciate that. Let's get into your backstory a little bit. Tell me about your early life background. Where'd you grow up? And then how did you get into your financial freedom journey?
Yeah. So again, appreciate you having me. I'm a longtime listener. So a little bit of an interesting background. Born and raised in Orlando, Florida. I tried to get out quite a few times, but just kept coming back, work and school and everything kept me here. But growing up, I graduated from UCF and I was really looking at ways to make as much money as I could immediately out of school. And a very long story short, I kind of fell backwards into the retail car business and realized very quickly that I enjoyed making good money from a young age, but at a certain point, I didn't want to continue to trade my time for money. And I looked at different careers and the corporate ladder and the ladder I was looking at within selling cars, and it was like, hey, I got to find another path. So I'm sure we can kind of dive a little bit more into this. I tried drop shipping, some e-commerce sites. I looked at starting an ATM business on my own, and eventually I landed on real estate really as the best way at that point, 2014, 2015, to trade my time for money. And I can obviously dive a lot deeper into that. That's really what led me to real estate, buying my own deals, and eventually looking at diversifying through a lot of LP investments as well.
Okay. So you said this about 10 years ago, out of college. What did you go to school for?
Initially finance, but I graduated with a degree in marketing.
Marketing. Okay. And so you had tried a couple different businesses or entrepreneurship roles, and then you ended up going into joining a business, right? So you had a W-2 job. What year was that?
I graduated in 2012, and I've still got a W-2 now in a similar industry, but graduated in 2012 and went straight into W-2.
Okay, so how long were you at that first job out of college?
Yeah, I was 23, just turned 23 when I got that first job.
And then how long were you there, and then at what point did you start looking into real estate?
I was there probably with that same company. I'd moved into the finance position. I was with that same company. I started investing. I was 25. So I was there for about two and a half years before I bought my first single family home.
Okay. So what led you down the path of real estate?
I touched on a little bit earlier, but I was working 60 hours a week and was making good money for being 25 at that time. And I looked at trading the trade-off of my time and really freedom and flexibility for money. And looked at a couple of different options, all of which with me working that amount of time, still needing that income, didn't really allow me to do both. The e-com drop shipping, ATM business, a couple others, it didn't allow me to really make that trade-off. I still had to run a business and deal with customers with both of those. So looking at real estate, I looked at it in two ways. One, to somewhat oversimplify, it's not entirely passive once you buy a property. But once I bought that property, had property management in place, took a very cookie cutter approach. But once I bought that property, I could manage that asset fairly easily. I bought them in Orlando where I live. I could manage those fairly easily. And it was, I think for me, that as well as the compounding over time, not wanting to get hooked on that immediate gratification of a flip, but buying and holding them, buying, buy, rent, rehab, refinance, over a long enough time horizon, that started to make sense for me. And you looked at the compounding from when I started when I was 25 and you rinse and repeat that strategy over time. And looking back, I'm happy I did it.
Yeah. And as I mentioned in the opening, I had a very similar path. I relate to that extremely well. So before you got into that first deal, What was the background? What was the educational piece? Did you just buy the first house you saw? How was that process that led you to closing on your first rental?
Yeah, great question. So I was listening to the Best Ever podcast every day into work. You guys, Bigger Pockets, a couple others. But I was obsessed. Again, I was working 60 hours a week, but 30-minute drive into the office, a 30-minute drive home, nights, weekends. I spent 6 to 7, 8 months consuming as much content as I could. I was on forums nonstop. And I was on the apps, Realtor and Zillow, nonstop looking at properties, what's going to make a good rental, what's not. I knew Orlando pretty well, born and raised here. And the first property I bought was actually, there was a few pieces to it, but somebody was trying to flip it and it got left on market for a little while. I ended up buying it for about $79,000. It looked like a pretty cookie cutter home. I put about $5,000-$6,000 into it. And I knew it was going to rent based on comps for $1,000-$1,100 at that time. This for me feels safe enough. It's going to be a good property to get into. And my litmus test was buying this, again, with reasonable, as much certainty as you can have. Like, I don't think I'm going to lose money on this. I don't necessarily think I'm going to make a home run, but I don't think I'm going to lose money. It's going to be a safe one to get my feet wet and then get the momentum.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, you said you bought this about 10 years ago. What was your purchase price then? And then what do you think it'd be worth today? I know you said you sold some of those, but just curious.
Yeah, what it would be worth today. Yeah, I sold it about 2.5 years after I bought it. I had refied and pulled my money out during that time period. I paid $79 for it in 2015. Yeah, today it's probably worth around $200, $220, $225, if I had to guess.
Okay. So double to triple the value over, let's call it 9, 10 years.
Yeah.
And the reason why I like asking those type of questions is because I think so many people, especially new investors, don't understand just how powerful real estate is over time. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of people out there writing books or on social media trying to sell people on the dream of this get rich quick scheme. But I think traditional real estate investing is definitely a get wealthy slow. And that's a prime example of looking at just what one house could have done for you financially over time. So you said you sold it a few years in, and I know you started acquiring some other rentals. So how did that journey go from the first one to your last active deal?
So my last active, over a period of probably 4 to 5 years up until just before the pandemic in late 2019, I had bought that single family. I got into another duplex that I actually split with my dad. Both of those on the journey up, I ended up refining that single family home and then I sold it. And then the duplex I split with my dad, we did a refi to get me out of it. We had different investing trajectories. And from there, I bought 2 more townhomes and 3 duplex all in the Orlando area. And I had refied, I think, my entire portfolio at least twice on the way up. And that was the nice thing. And again, that was fortunate with interest rates generally trending down, especially post-COVID, was able to, in most situations, keep my payment the same or lower my payment in pulling a substantial amount of the cash I put into it on the way. But a lot of them I did end up buying off market. Not all of them, but that was something that was, I think, I had some really good returns for the ones that I bought off market. But honestly, some of the ones that were purchased on market, I was very aggressive with coming in quick when they first hit, and those worked out well for me as well.
That's a great tip. Definitely want to be the first to act, whether it's on or off market. If you can get direct to the seller, or if something goes live on the MLS or LoopNet or Crexie, yeah. I've had a lot of success being the first one there because it shows you're serious, you're paying attention. And I don't know how true this is, but as an agent, a lot of the agent training they give us is usually your first offer is your best and your most serious. That's the rule of thumb in the business. So yeah, it's great advice. So let's back up a little bit to your W-2 and your entrepreneurial side. I know obviously you were investing actively in real estate. You started acquiring some properties over that 5-year span from 2015 to 2020. But how did you reach financial freedom during that time? And I know that's part of what we want to talk about today. What was that journey like financially?
It was hard. I was very, if I had to use one word, disciplined from my own personal spending. Your lifestyle creep a lot. I was making good money, not insane money. Again, probably relative to different people, but making good money. But lifestyle creep did not impact me. I was very disciplined with spending. I was a points junkie with traveling and everything, which was nice. But very disciplined with spending. And really from the first time I started investing up until, and even really to a degree now, but up until 2020, 2021, I lived on a pretty set income and funneled everything back into my investments. And I got to 10 units of my own, but a couple with Ashcroft, a couple with the sponsor groups, and got to a point really around 2019, 2020, as I started getting into some of those LPs. I was like, I looked up and my net passive income, not gross, but my net passive income is right at my W-2 salary. And it was such a grind. It was difficult. Again, a lot of sacrifices and trade-offs that were made to get to that point. But man, to wake up and I'm making every month what I make for my W-2, it was an incredible feeling. And again, a lot of people we talked about in the pre-show can retire and decide to step away. But I enjoy what I'm doing and happy to keep going. But it was a difficult, long journey, but it was an incredible feeling.
Yeah. As I mentioned, I relate to your story so much. I was a police officer before I went full-time in real estate. I reached financial freedom at either 30 or 31, right around that same time. I left my law enforcement job and same situation, right? All this time I had been working 80 hours a week, business, jobs, real estate, and then saving all my money that I could and living very frugally. So when I reached financial freedom and I had the ability to retire, my expenses were like $3,000 a month, which are obviously very low compared to the national landscape. And one thing you mentioned I want to spend a little time on is lifestyle creep. So how did that affect you when you were able to, quote unquote, retire, be financially free, and have that option to work? Has that impacted you at all, or are you still able to live frugally like you did 10 years ago?
Yeah, now I'm having to walk it back just a little bit sometimes because that became such a discipline and a habit of asking us, hey, do I need this? What are some of the alternatives? But still, in many ways, it's been beneficial just because it's been part of who I am. I got to a point when it's just a muscle. Early on, especially when you're young, you're 25, 26, 27. I lived in the town that I grew up in, both high schools I went to and college. And there's trade-offs, there's sacrifices. But I'm happy. I would do it all over again. But it became just this muscle that got built up. So now, again, I almost have to unpack it a little bit and relax sometimes. But I would much rather have to consciously loosen the reins a little bit from a spending standpoint than the alternative. So now I'm having to think, I can't enjoy that. I can't indulge here. There's a couple larger single purchases that I've allowed myself to make over the last few years. But from a day-to-day standpoint, almost like a personal OPEX standpoint, from an expense standpoint, I'm still pretty disciplined and haven't let my expenses creep up too much.
Well, that's great. And it is challenging. I'll say personally for me, when I reached financial freedom, I had built this really robotic, habitual, frugal type of life. In my past relationship, it caused a lot of fights and straining because if your partners aren't on the same page, it's going to create issues. And then my fiance now, she's the opposite. She's the type, she likes to spend money. She likes to have a good time. And she's much more live for the moment, not playing 50 years down the road, which is kind of where my mind's always at. So she's a good balance for me because she helps me realize we got young kids. We need to enjoy life. We need to have experiences. And who cares how much money we have in 30 to 50 years if we're not enjoying life on the road to get there. So there's definitely a balance to be found there. And her and I are good partners in that because we both have the opposite traits that help balance each other out.
Maybe just one note on this. This just came to my mind. I used to have weekly touch bases with my wife from a where's our budget at? And I personally need to probably do this a little bit better. Instead of looking at what can we cut back, maybe looking ahead at, okay, now what can we loosen up a little bit now that we've hit this point? So that just came to mind. So I appreciate that, Joe. Thanks.
We'll get back to the show. But first, some sponsors I'm confident you'll find value in learning more about. If you're an investor like me, you're probably looking for one platform to manage the banking and finance needs of your entire portfolio. The good news is there is one. It's called Baselane, and it's the number one banking platform built for independent real estate investors that reduces busy work so you can focus on growing your business. With Baselane, you can earn up to a 4.19% annual percentage yield and 5% cash back on debit card spending with no monthly fees. With a simplified view of your cash flow and expenses, you can retire those tedious spreadsheets. You can also manage unlimited virtual accounts and cards, and even open separate accounts for each property or unit. Join more than 40,000 real estate investors who trust Baselane for their banking, property management, and bookkeeping. Head over to baselane.com/Joe and sign up today for a chance to win a $500 Amazon gift card. That's baselane.com/Joe.
Do you want to do bigger and better commercial real estate deals? Take your real estate capital raising efforts to new heights with syndicationattorneys.com. With more than 20 years of real estate and investing experience, SyndicationAttorneys.com goes beyond just creating legal documents. They educate you on ethical and legal capital raising strategies. Plus, they offer a host of free resources, including their best-selling capital raising books, numerous articles, and their popular podcast, Raise Private Money Legally. At SyndicationAttorneys.com, they do more so you can do more. More deals, bigger deals, and better deals. So if you want attorneys with premier experience helping syndicators and fund managers raise capital, go to syndicationattorneys.com today to schedule an appointment and unlock your maximum capital raising potential today. That's syndicationattorneys.com. This offer is not available to Florida residents.
So let's talk a little bit about your LP investments. I know you mentioned you've invested in several funds, different operators, different syndications, things like that. And I think in your background, it said you had some unique type of assets you'd invested in. So if you could talk a little bit about the different things you've invested in and why.
Yeah, I got involved on the LP side really for two reasons. One, I did not have the time to continue to find my own deals and then really not just get under contract and find the deal, but then the financing and everything that goes along with that. So the other was I was only in Orlando and I wanted to look at getting into other markets. So initially I got into multifamily. I feel like that's probably most people early on what they tend to get into. But I got a multifamily and then I looked at diversifying across a couple other asset classes within real estate and even just really PE, but got into retail, car washes, oil and gas, one senior living development and ATM.
Yeah, that's definitely a diverse range there. And when I talk to different people who have passive investments on this show, I love to get into your mindset of what do you look for in your LP investments? Is it the operator? Is it their system? What specifically draws you to making investments?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You look at it one of two ways. There's the asset and then there's the operator. When I look at it, not necessarily that one comes before the other, but for me, when I was looking at the types of assets to get into, multifamily initially, just because I was so familiar with and I could better underwrite those deals in the markets. But I got into retail because of just the supply and demand imbalances. And I think what is a little bit of a contrarian approach. And now you're starting to see some more positive news about the retail side of the business just because of how undersupplied we are. I got into the ATM space as a way to, and again, a little bit contrarian with people and even for me, thinking that we're going to go to digital currencies, cryptocurrencies. But if you look at the margins on the ATM business and the trajectories of those, they are performing incredibly well because their customer base is the underbanked, unbanked, and it's really a section of the market that people don't pay attention to that has been performing incredibly well. And there's a lot of downside protection there. So 2020, 2021, that became an alternative investment for me outside of real estate, which I actually looked at more, not so much from a cash flow standpoint, 4 or 5% is fine from a cash on cash, but I looked at more of the multifamily, even some of the retail as an appreciation play. The ATMs there for me balanced that out with more immediate cash flow. And then just from a line of thinking, again, retail, multifamily from a portfolio standpoint, car washes for me, I think they're going to end up getting overbuilt, but got into car washes 2-3 years ago. And from an overall industry standpoint, it was very attractive, both from the fact that it's not valued like real estate, it's valued more of a multiple of EBITDA than it is on a cap rate. And it provided a little bit of diversification outside of traditional real estate. And then lastly, we're looking at oil and gas for me. This was more of a recent play. And honestly, I'm not as well versed in oil and gas as I probably should be to invest. But for me, just the logic there was that if inflation does maintain high, and again, just taking a little bit of a contrarian approach with the economy not going into recession, oil demand still being strong and with the economy holding up decently well, that means the Fed's not going to lower interest rates, which means there's still going to be a little bit of strain on multifamily. Oil and gas is going to continue to perform decently well. Thankfully, that kind of thesis has held up. But across the board, that's just a quick snapshot of the logic and the high level thesis I used for each of those.
Yeah.
For me, and I didn't touch on the operators, I generally am more of a fan within each of those. You want to make sure you're betting on the jockey, typically not the horse. So it's one thing to look at the asset class, but you got to make sure you're getting in with the good operator, because great operator can make a bad deal okay, maybe even great, but a bad operator can make a great deal really underperform.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. So two things I want to dive into a little more. The car wash business. Now, when you say you're investing in these, I know LP position, is this syndication funds? Is this single operators that are going out and buying individual car washes? Are they buying portfolios of car washes. Can you give me just generalities or examples of what that might look like?
Yeah, so it's typically a fund, or it is a fund where they're purchasing. I think the lowest that I've been in has been where they bought three different washes. I think the biggest was seven. I'm in three different funds. What's included in those funds, it can vary from a mix of just developed and the developer's looking to sell it to just underperforming assets in solid markets.
Now, are these mom and pop car washes, drive-throughs, are these self-service, or are these the big franchise? Like here, I don't know what you have out where you're investing, but here in Cincinnati, Ohio, we have Mike's Car Washes, Mike's Express all over the place. What types of car washes are these?
They're typically the automatic drive-throughs. They're not the self-service. And the owners are, yeah, generally mom and pops.
Okay, gotcha. Now, what is your expectation of return? You don't have to give a specific for a deal, but when you're looking at a deal like that, how does that contrast to real estate as far as expectations?
Yeah, my expectations, and this is also something when you look at a normal investor, and I got caught up into this, I think, early on too, is you see the marketing decks and the pro formas, and it's like, oh my God, and I've talked to a number of other LPs about this. I'm guaranteed 20% they put in the marketing deck. So it's not something that, from a return standpoint, I look to get 15% IRR. I like to balance that out, whether it's more cash forward and less appreciation. I like to try to keep a relative balance of that in my portfolio. The car wash is, again, I think we're probably okay now, but we are eventually at some point going to get overdeveloped, overbuilt. You know, I think that's just the normal curve of how these things happen and the amount of hype behind them right now. So whether right now we're getting good cash return, and if we exit soon or if we exit in a handful of years, I generally just look across the board for a 15% return.
Okay, that makes sense. And then my last question on your LP investments are with the ATMs. So how does that work? Because I don't know anything about that specific type of LP investment.
Yeah, so basically with the group that I'm with, they've been in this space for, I think, roughly 15 years. And in a way, it is a little bit of a real estate play. They've got real estate carved out in thousands of different locations for placement of the ATMs. And what they do is they raise a not entirely continuous, but they're in a consistent capital raise that goes on to where they're now replacing their outdated ATMs, and they're using the capital to basically just replace ATMs in the same real estate. What they also do is they buy up smaller mom and pop operators, and they get economies of scale because they're one of the largest ATM operators in the country. And so they just incorporate those into their portfolio. It's funny where when I started, I mentioned this earlier, looked at starting my own ATM business, and I was looking at the economics of it, and it was pretty remarkable. Heavy cash up front, you get a ton of cash, not even up front, just a heavy cash from the actual investment, but not a lot of really upside. Those ATMs are going to have a life of 5 to 7 years. You can't really resell them, but they throw up a ton of cash flow, and they've been performing very well.
So give me an example. Again, I have no idea, and you can break it down. Let's just use this for easy math. I got one ATM here in Cincinnati in strip mall or whatever. What could I expect as far as, and let me back up even further. I'm assuming I'm making money off of fees or some other type of fee. I'm not sure what all that it could do. And then what could I expect in cash flow?
So typical ATM is going to cost brand new in $5,000 to $6,000. You could expect roughly 50% of that return per year. And that's roughly what the fund does from a growth standpoint, not paid to LPs, but roughly 50% of that paid year one. So you could expect roughly $250 for that ATM, depending on the location. Some will perform a little bit better, some a little bit worse, obviously. And most of their revenue is made on just a per transaction basis. It's a 3-4% fee.
Gotcha. Now I'm making another assumption here, but I'm a member of the Fifth Third Bank, which is like a big regional bank here in Cincinnati. And I think they're spreading out all over the place. But I'm assuming a big bank like that, they own their own ATMs. It's not some company like this fund may have where they're doing like third-party servicing for a bank. Is that a correct assumption or am I off?
Yeah, most of the big banks own their own. Sometimes I think they do a licensing agreement, but yeah, most of the big banks, I know Fifth Third decently well, but yeah, most of the big banks will own their own.
Okay. So a lot of these are the one-off mom and pop type of ATMs where you're in a gas station, you're in a bar, a restaurant, whatever, something like that. Not necessarily the drive-through ones that are on the banks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The bars, hotels sometimes. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome, man. Well, I appreciate you sharing all your insights into that. Are you ready to transition to our best ever lightning round?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Give me your best ever book recommendation.
I feel like this changes every week. Right now, it's Fooled by Randomness by Nassim Taleb.
Awesome. Give me the best ever way you like to give back.
time. I like helping and coaching, mentoring other people, whether it's kids from alma mater from UCF, guys that are in my fraternity, just friends, coworkers even now, especially with the investment space. So I love coaching, mentoring.
Give me a mistake you made in one of your investments and the lesson you learned from it.
This is painful. There's probably two, but I did not check the electrical panel on a deal that I bought off market and cost me about $15,000 to replace. It was a Pacific style panel with aluminum wire.
Federal Pacific.
Yep.
Gotcha. Yep. Yep. We deal with those here in Cincinnati all the time. That's a tough one. Definitely want to get your inspection, no doubt. All right. The last question I have for you is, where can people connect with you, learn more about what you're doing?
Probably two places. One on LinkedIn. I'm fairly active on LinkedIn. So feel free to reach out, ask me questions. I love interacting, engaging with people, whether it's in my line of work with my W-2 or real estate investing. I can talk all day. So connect with me on there, or a little risky, I always give my cell phone, but feel free to shoot me a text, me a call. Myself, 407-766-2861.
We'll be sure to link to that in the show notes as well. I really appreciate your time and diving into your financial freedom journey, your active and your passive real estate journey. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, absolutely. Appreciate you having me on, Joe. Thanks.
Best ever listeners, thank you so much for joining in. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to leave us a 5-star review and share this episode with someone who may gain value from it. Remember to follow and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss anything. Thank you all for listening and have a best ever day.
Hi, best ever listeners. Joe Fairless here again. And one last thing before you go, would you like to receive a short weekly email with proven tips from experienced investors, free tools and resources, and a roundup of the week's most relevant news and best ever content? Well, if so, join the community of nearly 15,000 commercial real estate passive and active investors who receive the best ever newsletter. Just go to bestevercre.com/access. And you'll get the very next one. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, thank you for listening and have a best ever day.